In 1967, as the soldiers of Tzahal began to approach the old city of Yerushalayim, in what was one of the most defining moments of modern Jewish history, a moment where the Jewish people would reclaim a temple site that had been foreign to us for over 2,000 years, a moment where young boys were literally streaming from all different sections of the city of Yerushalayim towards the old city, all with one goal, with one ambition, with one mission in mind to ultimately recapture and reclaim that Kotel HaMaravi, that Har HaBayis, that Temple Mount. And two soldiers of the paratrooper unit of the Tzanchanim were running alongside each other through all of the alleyways, through all of the narrow passageways of the old city, taking fire, returning fire, literally risking their lives with each and every step to finally approach the holy stones of the Kotel HaMaravi of the Western Wall. And as they descended the stairs and found their way to those holy stones and placed their fingers upon those stones for the very first time in Jewish history for so many thousands of years, they carried with them the legacy not just of themselves and their parents, but their grandparents and great-grandparents. And these particular two soldiers, as they stood next to each other, they both begin to cry. And one of them is a soldier that has a strong background in his Jewish identity. This soldier has been praying for years and years, V'Yerushalayim Yircha B'Rachamim Tashuv, praying to God that God give us the opportunity and the chance to return to Jerusalem. Something that was alive only in their prayers, only in their hopes and their dreams, was finally coming to fruition. And so he stands at the site of the Kotel HaMaravi and tears begin to drip down his face. And standing next to him is another very brave and courageous young warrior of the Israel Defense Force. A young warrior who did not grow up with so much of a Jewish background, more of a cultural Israeli background. A young warrior that did not know Shema Yisrael from the Shmona Esrei, did not know any of the primary aspects of Jewish life in terms of the content of our liturgy and our prayers. A young warrior to whom this entire experience was somewhat more of a sense of a notion of the Jewish people, and very, very much less so a sense of the content and the nevuos and the prophecies and all the elements of Yahadus that accompany the world of Yerushalayim. And they both begin to cry. So the soldier who grew up without the religious background turns to the religious soldier and he says, "Why are you crying?" So that soldier responds, he says, "I'm crying because for thousands of years my ancestors have been praying to return to this spot. Jerusalem is the center of our world, the center of our life. We daven three times a day facing Yerushalayim. I've been waiting for this moment. My grandparents have been waiting for this moment. I cry because this is the point of desolation of our temple. This symbolizes the glory of the Jewish past with the hope of the Jewish future. I'm crying because of my relationship with Yerushalayim, with the world of Jerusalem." And then the religious soldier turns to the more secular soldier and he says to him, "Well, why are you crying?" And this soldier turns to his friend and he says to him, "I'm crying because I don't know even what to cry about. I'm crying because I know that there's significance here. I know that there's power here. I can feel the vibrations of Jewish history and Jewish destiny all around me. And yet I find myself unable to connect to what it is that is the substance of this experience." And I think that for teenagers sitting on the floor in 2011, trying to connect to an experience of Jewish history that's so elusive to so many of us, this really captures our challenge, our experience. For so many of us, we don't even know what we're crying about. It's so hard to connect to a world of a temple, a world that stood 2,000 years ago, a world that just every single day becomes exponentially further and further from our current technological experience of living. A world that even if we were to be able to connect to the glory of having the presence of God be manifest within our world, a world that by definition, with its centrality of sacrifices and various rituals of kachim and taros, the concepts of the laws of purity, a world that just seems so foreign, so alien to us. And yet here we are, we're sitting on the floor and we're in mourning, what the Gemara calls an avelus yeshana, a mourning for an experience that happened so long ago where it is so difficult, it's so challenging to connect to the essence of what this is all about. And so we engage in the rituals of this mourning. We are not saying hello, we are not greeting one another. We have not washed ourselves. We have not anointed ourselves. We're not eating, we're not drinking. We've refrained from the happiness and joy latent in Torah study and exploring the essence and texts of our heritage. And yes, we find ourselves sort of manufacturing in an environment and an experience that is solemn, that is sad. But at the end of the day, as we stand at our very own Kotel this morning, and we touch those stones, those ancient stones of the experience of the Beis HaMikdash, and we turn to our right and we see so many people for whom the tears flow because they know what it is they're crying for. For us, it's such a challenge. It's so difficult because for us, we're not even sure what it is that we're really supposed to be crying for. How do we connect? How do we contemporize this experience of Tisha B'Av? How could we find the Tisha B'Av in our life so that we could walk away from this day, from this experience, not just as a hiatus from the joys and liberation and excitement and passion of living life as a Jewish teen, but in really connecting to what the experience is supposed to be all about. So I want to share with you a perspective on Tisha B'Av that is based on the thoughts of Rabbi Soloveitchik in his commentary to the Kinos. The Kinos are a series of tefillos, a series of prayers that we're going to read today, that try to unpack, that try to reveal, that try to take us through an emotional journey of what it means to have our the center of our religious life, of our emotional life, of our theological life, ripped from our world. And in one of the very first kinos that we're going to say, we will recite the following words. Eicha atzta ve'apecha le'abeid biyad edomi memunecha. We say to God, we scream to God, how could you rush in your wrath? How could you ruin your loyal people at the hands of Rome? You don't remember the legacy of Avram Avinu, of Yitzchak, of Yaakov, of the covenant that you made with our forefathers, with our patriarchs, with our matriarchs, with the commitment of the enduring, lasting legacy of the Jewish people. And we scream at God, Eicha, how is this possible? Zichar Hashem Mahayalanu. How could you forget? God, you have to remember what it is that happened to us. And asks Rabbi Soloveitchik a very simple question. And that is, where do we get the gall to talk like this to God? Where do we get the chutzpah to look at HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to look at the Almighty and to say, Eicha atzta ve'apecha? How could you? Where do we get the unbelievable arrogance to open up so many of these kinos and the entire Megillah that we read last night, the Megillah that we read on Tisha B'Av night, with the words Eicha, with the words how? Don't we know that Jewish theology is based so much on a famous Gemara in Brachos, Chayiv Adam Livarech Al Ara K'Shem Shemivarech Al Tova, that God is good, that God ultimately wants what's best for us. And while things happen in the world that are so difficult and challenging to understand, at the end of the day, we embrace the notion, the fundamental idea that God is good and that God does not commit evil. And that even though we can't possibly comprehend how some of the experiences of Jewish history could in any way be congruent with that image and that feeling of God, nevertheless, we entrench ourselves in a sense of faith, in a sense of emunah, in a sense of bitachon, that no matter what happens, ultimately it's for the best, ultimately it relates to the goodness of God. Dayona emes, the Gemara says. We don't have to express that we're happy when something bad happens, but the simmering theological feelings that are underneath those expressions have to ultimately be rooted in an enduring commitment to the goodness of God. And so therefore asks the Rav, how is it possible that on Tisha B'Av morning we could look at God and we could say, Eicha atzta be'apecha? How do we talk like this to God? How could you? And says Rabbi Soloveitchik that the permission to do this, the permission to step outside our theological comfort zone, the opportunity to confront God in such an overt way, to strip away the coverings that we have of our true, sometimes doubts and feelings and cares and concerns about our relationship with God in the context of evil that happens to us in the world. This is all as a result of the life and legacy of one person. And that individual's name is Yirmiyahu HaNavi. Jeremiah was a prophet whose entire life was devoted to the preaching of doom and gloom. This was a man who woke up in the morning and he literally made videos for Tisha B'Av for the OU all day and all night. He never got to stand in front of a congregation and uplift them and inspire them with something that had a more optimistic message. He never got to stand at a wedding, at a chasana, and give a chasan and kala, bride and groom, a sense of hope and vision for the future. He was the guy that you see on the FDR holding the big sign that says, the end is near. He's the guy on Venice Beach holding up the big sign, repent now, the end is near. The guy that everyone walks by and says, oh my God, what a lunatic, what a crazy person. And that's what they did. They taunted him. They made fun of him. They ridiculed him. And his entire rabbinic career, one of the most eloquent prophets in the history of the Jewish people, his entire experience in serving Am Yisrael was in painting a picture of destruction, in painting a picture of impending doom that would befall the Jewish people if they did not change their ways. This is not someone who would have won a rabbinic popularity contest. This was someone who lived a life of extreme challenge, of extreme difficulties. And yet Yirmiyahu embraced his job, his destiny. He understood that every prophet has their time and place. And God sends, in the course of Jewish history, leaders that could speak to the needs of the generation. And Yirmiyahu understood that these are the needs of this generation, and so he continued to prophesy these messages, even though he understood that he would not develop a following of the Jewish people who were comfortable, who were happy, who were uplifted by his message. And when the day of destruction finally came, when someone who had been living with the anticipation, with the foreknowledge that this would ultimately unfold, and all of the Jewish people began to realize as the fires went up, as the homes were ignited, as people were slaughtered, as the temple burned, and they came running after Yirmiyahu saying, we want to repent now, you were right, you were right. And as they're carted off to Babylonia, to Babel, Yirmiyahu goes running after them to give them a little bit of comfort. Not an I told you so, not a this is what I told you was going to happen, but a sense of chizuk, a sense of comfort and foundation for their long journey of exile ahead. Yirmiyahu HaNavi was somebody who devoted his entire life to trying to shift the Jewish people and ultimately was unsuccessful. And at that moment of destruction, we can only imagine what was going on through his heart, what was transpiring in his mind. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Yirmiyahu the license to not approach God and his experience of suffering within the framework of traditional Jewish theology. God allowed Yirmiyahu to ask the question, Eicha. God allowed a window of opportunity in time where people could speak what they were really feeling, what they were really thinking. Where Yirmiyahu could look at God and say, I wish I could tell you that I embody at this moment the chai of Adam livarech ala ra, kashem shimavarech ala tov. I wish I could say dayana emes, but I can't. I'm seeing so much destruction, so much suffering. All I could say is eicha, how? Where is this God of mercy? Where is this God of rachamim? Where is this God that takes care of his Jewish people? Eicha atzta be'apecha, how could you lash out at them? And so says the Rav, Yirmiyahu is the matir. Yirmiyahu is the one who grants us permission for a few hours every single year, just on Tisha B'Av, to look at God and to say to God, Eicha. How is this possible? How could this happen? And we all have to ask ourselves, what does this mean that we could confront God in this way? What does it mean that there's this opening where you reveal your greatest doubts, your greatest concerns, your greatest troubles, and that's going on inside of you. These back and forth feelings that you want to embrace your faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but you've seen so much evil, so much destruction, you don't know how to resolve the two. And that even though normally we resolve them by saying, Dayan HaEmes, today we can say Eicha, today we can say, how is this possible? You know, a story is told. A story is told of a woman who, subsequent to the Holocaust, to her experience in the concentration camps, approached a Hasidic Rebbe. And in approaching the Hasidic Rebbe, she said to the Rebbe, I'm a survivor of the camps. I lost my parents. I lost my brothers. I lost my sisters. I lost a child. And she says to the Rebbe, and I'm telling you right now, that because of what I saw and because of what I went through, I will never light Shabbos candles again. And she walked away. And the Rebbe said, what am I going to tell you? And one of the Hasidim standing next to the Rebbe turns to him and he says, why did you let her walk away? Why didn't you try to explain to her? Dayana Emes, we don't understand, but we can't hold back. We don't understand, but next week you light the candles. And the Rebbe looked at the Hasid and he said to him, if after what this woman saw, if after what this woman experienced, she could still believe in God so strongly that she believes that by not lighting Shabbos candles, this is going to affect him. He's going to care about this. This is lashing back. Then her level of faith is deeper than you could ever imagine. It's deeper than any of you. Because sometimes anger and frustration and eicha is itself a manifestation of faith. Because there's something worse than confronting HaKadosh Baruch Hu and saying eicha. And that is walking away from God entirely. Tisha B'Av is the day where we recognize that within the framework of Jewish tragedy is the opportunity to look at HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the eye and to say, I will always believe. I will always believe. I will move on. There will be a tomorrow. I will put on tefillin later in the day at Mincha. I will get up from sitting on the floor. I will go home and eventually make Shabbos next week. But for these few moments, Eicha. I want to tell you, God, what I'm really thinking and what I'm really feeling. I want to reveal to you the raw human emotion, the turmoil that goes on inside us when we confront the greatest challenges in life. And the truth is that this is part of the Tisha B'Av experience, that all of us have Tisha B'Av moments in life. All of us have moments in life where we've struggled with our faith, where we've struggled with seeing something happen to somebody around us or somebody close to us. Some of us sitting on the floor today have sat on the floor before. And if we haven't, we have neighbors who have, we have parents who have. And if we haven't, please God, it should never happen to us, but there may come a point in time later where we will sit on the floor. And it could be we will confront those vulnerabilities that exist within our faith. Tisha B'Av has a message. And the message is that the worst thing you could do with your relationship with God is to walk away. It's to deny and suppress and not recognize those feelings of challenge, those feelings of distance that are real, that are true, that are raw. And that's what Tisha B'Av is about. That can't be part of our daily grind of Jewish life. We can't wake up every morning and have a little hour of Tisha B'Av. But there is a few hours a year where we could confront God and where we could ask these questions, questions that have no answers. You know, in Eicha itself, the first two parakim is Yirmiyahu just giving it to him. Yirmiyahu saying, look at what happened. I can't believe that this happened. I can't believe this element of the destruction and that component of the destruction. One after another, children and orphans and widows, and how could this be? And then somewhere in the middle of the third perek, the perek of Ani Agever Yirmiyahu begins to change his tune. He begins to get up off the floor like we do after midday on Tisha B'Av. And he begins not to look towards the past, but to look towards the future. And he begins to own the aspects of the Jewish people's behavior and perhaps even his own personal behavior that to some extent might have brought on these calamities. and he begins to recognize that there are things he could do that could progress the Jewish people and their destiny. And there begins to be a hope and a look towards the future. Not because Perek Aleph and Beis, the lamenting, the crying, the screaming, is something that never happened, but because at the end of the day, part of the avodah of Tisha B'Av is to get up off the floor. Is to get up off the floor and move forward. Not move on, but move forward. It's to recognize that there are moments of Eicha, and to recognize there are moments where Tisha B'Av is called a moed, where Tisha B'Av is called a holiday. There are elements where we move forward, where we progress. There's a beautiful story told that there is a man who sits today. You can visit him if you want this summer. He sits today at the plaza of the Kotel, and he cleans the stones of the Kotel. He's an elderly man named Binyamin. And Binyamin, every single day, wakes up in the morning, grabs a mop in hand, and he sits there all day, just mopping the stones of the plaza of the Kotel. And somebody once walked out to him, somebody who was working at the tunnel tours of the Western Wall, and they said to him, Binyamin, you know, who are you? Where'd you come from? It's only over the last 10 years. Because one of the most distinguishable aspects of this gentleman's procedure in cleaning these stones is he would hum a song. A song with the tune Yibaneh Beis HaMikdash, that God should one day rebuild the temple. And he would hum this song and he would clean the stones. The thing is, he didn't look like your typical, you know, person who would work in the field of maintenance, in the field of, you know, of cleaning floors. And so somebody walked up to him and said, you know, where's your background? Where are you coming from? You know, where'd you come from? So he says to them, I'll tell you the truth. For decades, I was a lawyer in a law firm in Tel Aviv. And it's only in the last few years that I've taken on this role of cleaning the stones of the floor of the Kotel. So they asked him, why would somebody who spent their whole life as a lawyer find themselves cleaning this floor of the Kotel? So he told them, let me tell you a story. When I was about bar mitzvah age, the Nazis invaded Galicia. And they took myself and my entire family to the camps. And I spent 2 years in Buchenwald. And during those 2 years, there was a ruthless commander of the camp named Hans. And this commander of the camp would always examine the various prisoners who were there and come up with meaningless tasks to provide for them, just to simply beat the resolution out of them, the life out of them, the breath out of them. And one day he selected myself and a friend of mine named Itzik. And he took us to his office. And he put us on the floor of the office and he said to us, here is a toothbrush. And he handed them a toothbrush and he said to them, I want you to clean the floors of my office with a toothbrush. And they got on the floor and they began to scrub. And he, of course, for his own horrific entertainment, would kick them and abuse them and beat them. And laugh at them, sucking any sense of dignity, any sense of humanity out of these people. And they began to clean, and as they were cleaning, Binyamin began to lose hope, to lose strength, to lose aspiration for ever getting out. Look where they were, look, it just did not seem like things could ever get better, like there was no more hope. And his friend Itzik said to him, you know what, let's sing. And they began to sing the tune of Yibaneh HaMikdash that they knew from their early youth. A tune, a very solemn tune, but a hopeful tune. A tune to a phrase that embodies the whole sense of hope and longing for a world of geula, for a world of redemption. And they began to sing this tune, and the commander hears them, he overhears them singing. And he overhears the word tzio. And familiar, I guess, with the linguistic parallels, he says to them, Zion, Zion, you're singing about your Zion. You're singing about your Jerusalem. Let me show you where you're going to see Jerusalem from. And he takes them outside and he shows them the crematoria and he shows them the smoke coming up and he says to them, you see that? From there you're going to see your Holy Jerusalem. That is the only vantage point from which you will ever witness the place of your holy temple. And he brings them back in and he kicks them to the floor and he commands them to continue cleaning. And he leaves the room. And at that moment, for some reason, Binyamin became so full of hope, so full of confidence, so full of positive energy, and he turns to Yitzhak and he says, let's keep singing. And they keep singing, and as he's scrubbing and as he's singing, he makes himself a promise. And the promise he makes himself is that if he were to ever be rescued, be liberated from this hell, that he would make his way to the land of Israel. And that at some point in his life, he would find the opportunity to sit and scrub not the floor of this Nazi animal, but the floors of the Holy Temple itself, of the spot of the Kotel HaMaravi, of the spot of the Western Wall. And he was liberated. And he did make his way to Israel. And he built a family, and he built a legacy. And he built a world and a community, and he practiced law for many years in Tel Aviv. And then when retirement came, he did not forget his promise. And he walked up to the municipality, the element of the municipality in charge of cleaning this area. And he said to them, I am joining this team. I am going to clean the stones of the Kotel HaMaravi. And to this day, if you go to the Kotel, you can find a man, an older man, Binyamin, cleaning those stones, singing Yibane HaMikdash, that one day that temple should be restored. Tisha B'Av is about taking a real hard look at our relationship with God, about recognizing that life is not perfect and not every moment is happy, and tragedy occurs and suffering occurs and things happen in life that are out of our control and that challenge our faith and challenge our relationship with God. And Tisha B'Av is a day where we don't suppress it, and we don't obfuscate it, and we don't deny it. We confront it head on, and we say, Eicha atzta ve'apecha, Eicha yashav adad. How could this happen? But it's also a day where we recognize that that confrontation with God, that feeling, that sensation of frustration and difficulty is in and of itself indicative of the way in which, the degree to which we are holding on so tight to make the relationship real. That out of the ashes of some of our greatest suffering comes some of the most intense relationships with the Ribbono Shel Olam, with the Almighty Himself, and some of the greatest hope, hope in the Jewish people, hope in our future. Tisha B'Av is a day where we mourn and we celebrate, because we confront and we acknowledge the fact that God never gave up on us. And Tisha B'Av is also a day where we mourn and we celebrate and we acknowledge that, you know what? We're never going to give up on Him. And so to all of us, as we move from the world of Tisha B'Av to the world of Tisha B'Av afternoon, and when we get up off the floor, and when we light Shabbos candles next Friday night, let's find some piece of our life, some piece of our life, of our relationship with God. Let's make it real. Let's open it up. Let's confront the questions. Let's talk to our mentors, to our rabbis, to the people around us. Let's not hold those doubts in. Let's discuss them. Let's figure them out. Let's work with the people around us, our mentors, the people who are available, who are there to help us work it through. And if we're not satisfied the first time, let's go back and ask again. It's not a relationship worth giving up on just because it's difficult and it's frustrating the first time. Let's use Tisha B'Av as an example and as a foundation to recognize that if we open it up and we're real about it, sometimes out of the greatest challenge could come the most fruitful and close relationships imaginable. And let's move ourselves forward to the day when Tisha B'Av itself becomes one of the most celebratory aspects of the Jewish calendar, where we celebrate not just the foundation of the Jewish people in terms of our redemption, but the foundation of the Jewish people in terms of the personal relationship with God that is possible between each and every one of us in our Creator. We just have to want it, and we just have to be real about it. I wish all of you a meaningful, meaningful fast, and ultimately to move forward together for the redemption of the Jewish people, that we should all be celebrating together with the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. B'mheira v'yameinu.